Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall and joining me here is Liz Martin, who will be talking to Dr. Darren Naish of the University of Southampton. So what's this episode all about?
This week, I guess, we're talking about the Wealden fossils. So any of the fossils coming from sort of the south of England in the Wealden supergroup, which Darren has worked on quite a bit, primarily, I guess, dinosaurs, but we talk a little bit about some other stuff as well.
Oh, that's nice and neat. I don't really have any follow-on questions to that. So that's Cretaceous, right?
Yeah, it's early Cretaceous.
And do you get any pterosaurs in there?
Yeah, there's a couple of pterosaurs that come out of there. Generally not fantastically preserved, though. They're sort of a couple of teeth or little bits and pieces, but there are a few pterosaurs.
And how do you know Darren? Was this just something through university?
Yeah, so I know Darren through the Southampton Vertebrate Paleontology Group. He kind of helps us out with stuff and does a few lectures here and there. So that's how I got to know Darren well. I guess I've met him previously through kind of conferences and the fact that he's worked on pterosaurs before. So I knew him previously, but got to know him better at Southampton.
And I guess a lot of people might already know Darren through his Tetsu blog and podcast.
Yes, definitely. He's quite prolific with the random tetrapod blogs and stuff. So
I hear they're almost as popular as PaleoCast.
Don't say that to Darren. No, it was good to be able to sit down with him, though, because he is quite busy with all of his blogging and writing of books and all of the other millions of things he does. So it was quite lucky that we were able to find a time that we could actually sit down and do it. So,
and I guess at this time we should wish all of our listeners a happy new year.
Yeah, happy new year, and hope everybody had a good holiday, if they had a holiday, all of that fun stuff.
And so what are your resolutions for this year?
I have honestly not even thought about it. I don't really do the whole New Year's resolution thing because I find that a week in, I've completely forgotten about it and not even bothered. So
do an academic one right here, right now.
I will at least submit 2 papers this year. How about that?
There you go. Sounds good. You heard it here first, people.
Well, what about you, Dave? You can't ask me and not give one yourself.
Well, something that happened is I got an award, a little grant from the Paleontological Association at the meeting, which is going to let me do a lot of lab work. So I'm going to be chopping up little spidery, scorpion-y things. So there's a lot of that for me to do.
Is that really a resolution?
It's not quite a resolution, was it? I'll do it. That's my resolution. I'm going to concentrate more on my PhD, get some lab work done, I think, because there's been so much else I've been doing with, I guess, the virtual Natural History Museum.
Yes.
Which I should mention is probably going to be launching very, very soon. So keep an eye out for that.
I'm going to say you should have a resolution for that as well.
Yeah, let's get that launched. That's everyone's that's collective resolution. Like, make sure that this museum is launched.
Yay.
Donate more to these kinds of projects. So we've got a whole section on our website dedicated to this project. So if you haven't yet seen it or listened to the audio about it, then you can find details about it there. And you can also join our Facebook and Twitter groups, just /virtualNHM. And then in other business, we'll be releasing the videos we recorded at the Paleontological Association meeting for anyone who missed the conference or the live stream. So keep an eye out for those. And in general, if there's any interviews you want to hear in 2016, please don't be afraid to get in touch by emailing in, tweeting, or leaving a comment. We read them all and we'll see what we can do for you. But without much further ado, we're going to kick off 2016 with an episode all about dinosaurs with the incredible Dr. Darren Naish. So we hope you enjoy this episode. We'll be right back.
Hi, Darren. Thank you for joining us. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into paleontology?
So I currently work as a freelance author, editor, consultant, and I'm affiliated with the research group here at the University of Southampton that you belong to as well. Mm-hmm. I've been working on, predominantly theropod dinosaurs from the Lower Cretaceous of England since about 1999, something like that. Did my PhD at the University of Portsmouth under Dave Martill, working predominantly on Eotyrannus, a theropod from the Isle of Wight. So I kind of feel like Wealden theropods have been with me from the start of my time in academia. But I've also worked on pterosaurs, marine reptiles, and have diverse interests in the world of tetrapods. And I run a little blog called Tetrapod Zoology, which is currently hosted at Scientific American.
So, of course, you've done a lot of work on the Wealden, as you mentioned, and stuff in the UK. So can we start out by talking about where in the UK you can find dinosaur fossils?
Yes, so the UK is a really rich dinosaur-bearing place. Although, of course, people have said that England is the home of dinosaurs. It's where dinosaurs were first recognised. A number of fossil species coming from the southeast, from East Sussex in particular. But many places around the UK, the islands around Scotland, the Dorset coast, the Jurassic coast, the Midlands, Leicestershire in particular, the Yorkshire coast, many of these places yield dinosaurs. And of course, because Western Europe is one of the kind of great seats of science, where, you know, people first invented the concepts of stratigraphy, geology, the fossil record, this kind of stuff. People have been naming and describing dinosaurs from England all the way back to the early 1800s. But the fossils, I don't need to tell you, this is obvious, the fossils they're dealing with are often scrappy little fragments. Mm. And of course, today, you could say that British fossils are often quite poor in quality compared to those that come from South America, China, Madagascar, but we've still got an important historical record. We've certainly got, in terms of the development of our science, we've got some of the most important specimens. They're not the best fossils in the world, but historically they're the most significant.
How old are these fossils? When were these dinosaurs in the UK living?
So we've got, the Mesozoic rocks in the UK span everything from the Triassic to near the end of the Cretaceous. We don't have stuff from the latest Cretaceous from, like, you know, say 70 million years ago or so. But otherwise, we've got things from every part of the so-called Age of Dinosaurs. So there's lots of Triassic dinosaurs in places like Wales and around Bristol. Mm. There's lots of Jurassic dinosaurs in the English Midlands and along the Jurassic coast, Dorset. And there's lots of Cretaceous dinosaurs, in particular in the Wealden, this area that corresponds to East Sussex and Surrey and parts of Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. In terms of which of those is richest, I mean, they all bear dinosaur fossils on a fairly regular basis, so long as things are happening, which means that new strata are being, as long as new, you know, new rock is being exposed. So the active erosion along the Jurassic coast of Dorset and along the Wealden coastline, that means you've constantly got new fossils, Cretaceous and Jurassic and Cretaceous dinosaurs being exposed. Where you've got active mining and pit building in the Midlands, you also have new fossils, not just dinosaurs, but marine reptiles, obviously, as well. Although the fact that that's now changed, you know, it's now more mechanised and it's the whole way the quarrying works, it's not done by hand anymore as it was in the 1800s, obviously means that people are discovering less stuff than they were. But I think we still are seeing, certainly along the south coast of England, new dinosaur specimens on, you know, a couple a year, fairly regular basis. So it's pretty rich dinosaur-bearing rocks, really.
The stuff that comes out of kind of Lyme Regis Jurassic Coast is marine. Do you get a lot of dinosaurs in that? Are there dinosaur fossils found that have floated out to sea or something?
There is a small number of early Jurassic dinosaurs that come from those marine rocks, Lyme Regis and Charmouth area. And in particular, there's an animal called Scelidosaurus.
Ah.
So we're only talking about one species, but we're talking about probably going on for 15 to 20 specimens, several of which are good semi-complete skeletons. So this is, why is this dinosaur? And there's other bits and pieces as well. There's bits of limb bones from large theropods. And again, we're talking about a couple of specimens, literally two or three specimens, that come from these marine rocks, where otherwise all the vertebrate fossils are fish and marine reptiles. So why are those dinosaurs in those Jurassic marine rocks? And we don't know the real answer, but among the several guesses, one is that these were coastal dinosaurs. They were dinosaurs living on beaches or foraging in lagoonal habitats at the water's edge. And maybe things happen, which means that when they die, their bodies are swept out to sea. Maybe they were frequenting the sea more often, although maybe they were, you know, living in the edge of the marine environment. I mean, that's kind of the main idea we have.
I'd heard of a lot of pterosaur or some pterosaur fossils being found in those same sort of localities, but it wasn't obvious or clear to me that dinosaurs had been found as well. I've heard of dinosaurs being found in marine formations, but not very many. So it's interesting to hear that even within kind of Lyme Regis and that area, there's dinosaurs as well as the marine reptiles.
Yeah, oh, there's a lot of strata worldwide, fully marine strata, where you get dinosaurs that, you know, they must have been hundreds of kilometers away from the paleo coastline.
So moving back to the Wealden and the Isle of Wight, what was the environment of kind of the Wealden rocks, of like what they were deposited in? What was it like back in the Cretaceous?
Yeah, so the Wealden is the name for this set of rocks that crop out in what's known as the Weald, this region that corresponds to the southeast of England, East Sussex, West Sussex, bits of Surrey, bits of Hampshire. And it's a series of mudstones, siltstones, sandstones, really complicated, famously complicated set of strata, representing something like maybe 25 to 30 million years. You're talking about a lot of variation in habitat, but as a generalisation, during the time period concerned, so from between, you know, 135 to 110-ish million years ago, across that sort of time frame, you're talking about floodplains crossed by a tropical environment, crossed by giant meandering rivers. Occasionally there are pools and lakes. And in the younger parts of the sequence, you've got an increasing amount of influx from the sea. So you've got like lagoonal deposits, so-called quasi-marine deposits. There are some highland areas around the fringes. Most of our, of course, you know, you could say the same for many famous fossil deposits. The fossils themselves come from like the lowest part of the sequence. They come from like where fossils have been gathered together into channels and estuaries and deltas. Doesn't mean the whole environment was like that, but from what we can tell from the fossils that end up in channels and these kinds of deposits, the areas of highland were some sparsely, some thickly vegetated, with a mostly dry adapted flora ranging from, you know, cycads and low-growing herbs to like sort of small conifers and stuff. So kind of low hilly areas with some scrub, enough to certainly sort of be good for hiding small animals, but then large, flat, often really hot floodplain environments. And it's also a strongly seasonal environment. So it ranges from really kind of probably quite hot, I want to say baking hot, but that might be a little bit too hot, but certainly a tropical floodplain environment to quite a cool wintertime climate. Strongly seasonal, with markedly different patterns of rainfall. So heavy rainfall during the cool seasons, no rainfall during the dry season, so basically like a desert. In this habitat, these habitats, I mean, yeah, as I say, talking about millions of years, quite a diverse array of animals, not just dinosaurs. But we've got a lot of stuff from these deposits.
What is the significance of the Wealden with respect to other localities? Are there other places in the world that show kind of a similar age or diversity or anything like the Wealden?
Yeah, so the Wealden, I mean, historically the Wealden is really important because it's one of the first places where people first found non-bird dinosaurs. And the Wealden itself was already a model of how we use strata to you know, to lithology and geology, how we use that to interpret ancient environments. And in terms of how it compares in age to other strata, well, surprisingly, despite all these other deposits we've discovered all around the world, parts of the Wealden still remain almost unique. Huh. There are the oldest parts of the Wealden come from the Berriasian, which is the very first stage in the Cretaceous. Mm-hmm. And that particular age is, I'm not sure it's represented anywhere else in the world. I'm not sure there are any other places where there are Berriasian dinosaur-bearing deposits. So all these Chinese deposits, Liaoning, they are similar age. There are North American sites, like the Cedar Mountain Formation, the Clovelly Formation. They are similar in age to the youngest parts of the Wealden. So Liaoning and North American places are both similar in age to the youngest parts of the world and have very similar faunas in some respects, similar faunas of iguanodontians, ankylosaurs, and so on. But in terms of the older parts of the world, no, it's still almost unique. I should say there's also Wealden equivalent strata on the European continent, where, again, corresponding only to the younger parts of the Wealden, where they have very similar animals. In some cases, they seem to have the same species, Iguanodon, Polycanthus, and so on. So the Wealden, even today, it's crazy. You know, the fact that we've been discovering fossils from there since the early 1800s, there's still, at this time, the possibility that you can find groundbreaking, earth-shattering dinosaur discoveries from the older parts of the Wealden. That would be globally important.
And have there been any of those sort of groundbreaking, you know, thinking if this is the place that, the only place in the world where that sort of age is being found, what kind of really important finds have been found from that?
Yeah, that's,
from the berries.
that's a really good question. Because the funny thing is that the dinosaurs that come from those older strata are all pretty scrappy. They're frustratingly scrappy. Mm. And why is that? I mean, as I mentioned a moment ago, that the nature of the fossils that we find, the way in which we actually find fossils is different. I mean, you go back 150 years, then all over the region corresponding to where Wealden sediments are, all over that region, there's like a million quarries everywhere. Every little village has got its own little pits, and that's where people are finding the fossils. They're obviously not doing that today. Mm. So today, you're only relying on stuff that occasionally tumbles out of stream banks, hillsides, and cliffs. And the number of dinosaurs found, in a lot of the places is quite, it's not many. But as to why they're so fragmentary, I mean, the taphonomic history of the region is kind of unusual as well, in that you tend not to have, so far we haven't yet found places in the Wealden where you have large numbers of dinosaurs that have kind of died mired in sediment, stuck in water holes. Mm. The sort of thing you have that in the Morrison Formation, Liaoning, you've got these giant mass death deposits where animals were smothered by volcanic ash or mudslides. We don't have that in the Wealden. Mm. And instead, we seem to have the remains of animals that have been lying out in the open, have been scavenged or have been rolling around in the flood waters or river waters, so they tend to be isolated bits and pieces. So we wish that there were something like Liaoning, where you had this mass death of lots of maybe small animals at the same time. We don't have that, so which is just, that's just a quirk of history, isn't it?
Well, it's really interesting thinking that this is the only place in the world that you can find dinosaur-bearing strata of that age, but that they're also so poorly preserved. It makes you wonder what was kind of happening in the world at that time, where the only place you can find it, they're just little scraps. So
yeah, it's annoying.
Yeah.
It's one of the frustrating vagaries, the lottery of the fossil record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The time that you really want to look at and see what was going on, you can't.
Yeah.
So we mentioned that there are other animals other than dinosaurs found in the Wealden. So what other stuff has come out of those formations?
Basically, you name it, and people have got it. So I only really know tetrapods. Don't really care about fish and other things. but if you were to talk to a paleoentomologist or somebody who works on like planktony things, little things. It's like the Wealden record of those is amazing. The diversity of insects in the Wealden is incredible. There's fine grained blocks in parts of the Wealden that are full of like loads of things. I can't even begin to list them, you know, midges and biting flies and all that kind of stuff. Mm. Then the fish fauna, there's a really diverse fish fauna containing everything from, I mean, there's famous large fish like the semi-anotiforms, these carp-sized freshwater things. There's like early sharks in some of the, well, technically not early sharks, but you know, advanced sharks, there's Neosalakian sharks. There's a diverse fauna of lizards, salamanders, frogs, and mammals. We always knew they were in the Wealden because people had found like one or two teeth and vertebrae, you know, going back 100 years. But since his research time overlaps with mine, Steve Sweetman, who's again affiliated with us here at Southampton and also with the University of Portsmouth, Steve Sweetman has used this bulk sieving technique to discover hundreds and hundreds of bits of microvertebrates. As he's now pieced together quite an impressive inventory of frogs and salamanders and stuff. And he's found bits of birds. There are small birds in the fauna. There are pterosaurs, as you know. Mm-hmm. There's Vecti Draco, and other pterosaurs, large pterosaurs as well. And then you're into dinosaurs, and obviously there's crocodiliforms, and there's marine reptiles as well. In fact, I say marine reptiles. I use that as a collective term for ichthyosaurs and brontosaurs. There are freshwater plesiosaurs in the Wealden. There's an animal that Roger Benson, Hilary Ketchum, Langham Turner and I published a couple of years ago, Vectoclidus pastorum, we called it, a dwarf freshwater plesiosaur that's known from the Vectis formation of the Isle of Wight. So a member of a radiation of plesiosaurs that seem to have been lagoonal, riverine, and living in large lakes and stuff during the Cretaceous, yeah. And we hope that there are dwarf freshwater ichthyosaurs as well. We haven't found one yet, but there's one in the Purbeck, which is the next younger stratum above the Wealden. There's a lagoonal, a lagoon-dwelling small ichthyosaur in the Purbeck, so it's not impossible that animals like that await discovery in the Wealden.
That's really interesting. I've never heard of freshwater plesiosaurs, because of course I don't work on them, so I have no idea about plesiosaurs. No, I had heard about the one that you guys discovered, but I didn't realize it was freshwater.
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah.
That is very interesting.
Yeah, and it's not a one-off. There's others as well. There's several species in the world and belonging to different groups that we think of freshwater plesiosaurs. So I should say they're not 100% dedicated freshwater. They might have been, but they also are probably, you know, like modern freshwater sharks. They can live in deltas and estuaries. They can move out to sea if they want.
Yeah.
But, well, they probably are mostly living in, you know, upriver.
Oh, that's really interesting. But of course, I'm more interested in dinosaurs. So we're going to go back to dinosaurs. Some of the stuff you've worked on was thought to be one of the largest dinosaurs in Europe at the time. Can you talk a little bit about that dinosaur and what it was and its significance?
Yes, so we've got quite a diverse assemblage of sauropods from the Wealden, from both the mainland Wealden and from the Isle of Wight as well, representing, it's still unresolved how many species there are. The problem there is that virtually all of the remains are non-overlapping. Like, one of them is based on vertebrae from the back, one of them is based on vertebrae from the neck, one of them is based on limb bones. This is the problem with these animals. Typical story for actually British dinosaurs. When Dave Martin and I were producing that book, Dinosaurs of the Isle of Wight, we were writing that in 2000, we learnt about a gigantic neck vertebra from an Isle of Wight sauropod dinosaur, and it hadn't been published. I was like, why haven't we even heard of this specimen before? We tracked it down, and it turned out that everybody involved in Isle of Wight dinosaurs, working in the museum, that kind of thing, the former Museum of Isle of Wight Geology, they all knew about it, but they don't kind of work on the same sort of way that we do. They don't sort of think, oh, wow, you've got it, let's work it up into a paper. So it had been mentioned here and there in magazine articles and newspaper articles. We went to find it. It had been prepared by a guy, the late David Cooper, a well-known preparator of Isle of Wight dinosaur bones. And it's a giant neck vertebra, it's complete over a metre long.
Wow.
But the centrum of the main body of it is about, I think it's 74 centimetres long, which is big enough. It's one of two. They've both been found by a guy called Gavin Leng, who's the same guy who Eotyrannus lengi is named for. Eotyrannus, the tyrannosaur from the Isle of Wight. And we realised that this giant vertebra, the second vertebra was really poorly preserved, very worn, just an eroded centrum. The first one was in good shape. We realised it's probably like from a brachiosaur type giant sauropod. And a bit of back of the envelope calculations from an animal similar in size to Giraffa Titan from Tanzania, Giraffa Titan branchi, so somewhere between 20 and 25 meters long, which is not stupendously large. As you know, we know of larger sauropods than that, but for Europe it's one of the biggest. And took us a couple of years to get the paper together. There's a long story behind its publication, but published it as this giant olive oak sauropod, maybe Europe's largest sauropod, only known from these two neck vertebrae. And it was published at about the same time as an animal from Oklahoma called Sauroposeidon proteles. And these two animals, Sauroposeidon and this Isle of Wight one, known affectionately as MIWG7306, they're similar enough for us to think that they're the same kind of animal. Which in recent phylogenies, they are, I think they're, are they early Sumphospondyls? They're not brachiosaurs anymore. They're early Sumphospondyl titanosauriforms. So they're sort of round about the so-called brachiosaur-titanosaur transition. We nicknamed it Angloposeidon. Sauroposeidon, Angloposeidon. And the promise was always that that's just a nickname and it will never get into print, but of course it now has. I've got it in books and stuff. So, and we do think it probably is a new taxon because it doesn't seem to be quite like any of the other wheeled and sauropods that have been named. And as for the thing about it being the biggest, well, of course, other larger animals from Europe have since been published, most notably Turiosaurus from Spain, which is one of the biggest sauropods ever. So,
has there been any other material found of like other bones that are anywhere similar to what you'd expect for an animal of that size?
Yeah, there's a couple of bits and pieces that look to be in about the right ballpark. There's the proximal end of a humerus, which has been from the Isle of Wight, which has been it has been published, but the nature of the literature on wheeled and dinosaurs and British dinosaurs in general is a lot of it's kind of scrappy. It's like there's one little paper here describing that, there's one little paper here describing that. There's still, I sort of want to be reluctant on encouraging people to publish more on British dinosaurs because there's a vast literature on them already. It's almost as if they're overstudied already. But it's only within recent years, people like Phil Mannion and Paul Upchurch that have kind of like started to collate it and sort of describe things alongside one another. And there's a bit of work to be done on that. But
how many groups or taxa of sauropods were present in the Wealden?
Well, that's... yeah, that's tricky to answer because there's a list of named species, but off the top of my head, I would say it's something like 10 to 15 species, but which could be wrong. I don't have a list with me. But in terms of whether that means 15 separate taxa, it probably doesn't because there might be cases where, you know, three or four named things probably do belong to the same animal. On the other hand, when people have looked at these, they do tend to find that the isolated bits and pieces seem to belong to different kinds of dinosaurs. So like there's one named for teeth, and those particular teeth don't look like those of any of the other groups that we've got. And then there's another one named from teeth, and again, similarly, it's like it's not the same as the first one named from teeth, and it's something completely different. It's really hard with these scrappy fragments.
Yeah.
And remember also, we're talking about animals that are not necessarily living alongside one another. Yeah. We're talking about animals that are sometimes tens of millions of years apart.
We talked about the biggest ones. So moving from that, obviously now I'm going to talk about small dinosaurs. Have there been a lot of finds of smaller dinosaurs? You talked about the microvertebrate stuff that has been found, but have there been equivalent kind of non-bird smaller dinosaurs that have been found from the Wealden?
So small theropods, well, we know, you've already hinted at the fact that Steve Sweetman has discovered all these small teeth that come from Chuodontid and Dromaeosaurid-type animals. But apart from those, the tiny theropods represented by bones, at the moment we've only got one bone that comes from a really, really tiny theropod. We haven't given it a proper name. We call it the Ashdown Manor apteryn. It's found at Ashdown in a clay pit. And it's a single vertebra, 7.1 millimetres long. A single vertebra, 7.1 millimetres long, which it's probably from an Oviraptorus, or so a Cordipteryx-type Manoraptoran, a little kind of turkey-sized theropod, a turkey-like, turkey-shaped thing, which has an estimated total length of around about 45 centimetres. Hmm. Now, we know from Jurassic and Cretaceous sites, again, mostly in China, that there are lots of small theropods of that kind running around in the Jurassic and Cretaceous. But whatever's happening in early Cretaceous England at the time, you're not getting whole things preserved. You're getting just like the little tiny fragments because they're getting broken up and just not preserved.
Are there any ideas about why the smaller dinosaurs aren't being preserved? Has anybody looked into any of the taphonomic biases or any possible reasons for that?
I don't think it's been, so far as I know, it hasn't been formally studied. There have just been like throwaway comments here and there. In the paper that Steve Sweetman and I did on the Ashdown Manoraptoran, we touched on this, and we said that there's some taphonomic filter in place. And I think I already said it's, there aren't volcanic events that are burying animals en masse. There are mudslide kind of events, but they're a seasonal thing that sweep across the floodplain, these debris flows.
You mentioned earlier that you had worked on the early Tyrannosauroid Eotyrannus. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and about Eotyrannus in general and its significance?
Yeah. We have known of predatory dinosaurs, theropods, from the Wealden since, I think it's going back to the 1850s. So we've known that theropods are in the fauna, in these assemblages, for a long time. And animals like... The amazing thing, in view of that, it amazes me that in a place as well explored and scientifically understood as England, people are finding new kinds of dinosaurs. Baryonyx is found in the 1980s, Neovenator is found in the 1990s, and you'd think by then that was it, surely there can't be any more. But no, this new predatory dinosaur was discovered round about the year 2000 by Gavin Lang, this local amateur paleontologist who's found loads of stuff. He found this theropod in a particularly awkward location in really, really hard sideritic sandstone. And our first assumption on looking at this dinosaur... This is all happening at the same time as the new dinosaur museum is being built. So there are all these, like, everyone is busy. Everyone in the Isle of Wight dinosaur world is busy with the moving things from the old museum to the new museum. Some of us are trying to put this book together that's got to be on sale by the time the museum opens. And it's like finding a new dinosaur, a significant one, and working on it is like the worst thing to possibly happen. For me, it was kind of good because at the same time, it was the same time as I was already gearing up to do my PhD, which was on Wealden theropods. The idea was to sort out the taxonomy of various kinds that had been described during the late 1800s. And our first assumption was that Eotyrannus would prove to be synonymous with one of the scrappy Wealden theropods that had been named during Victorian times. There's a whole list of them. Thecocelurus, Calamosaurus, Calamospondylus, Valdoraptor. We thought that Eotyrannus would be the same as one of those, or it would show that two or three of them were synonymous, that they belonged to the same animal. But that proved not to be the case. It didn't match with any of them. It was a distinct animal, a new one, and we realised straight away some of the best preserved bits of its skeleton. It's a partial skeleton consisting of about 40% of the animal. It's got some good bits of the skull, good bits of the forelimb, good bits of the pectoral girdle. I mean, it was obvious from some of these parts of the skeleton that this was a celurosaur, and specifically a tyrannosauroid. One of the best preserved bits of it, these fused nasal bones, have this anatomy that is distinctive and unique to tyrannosauroids. So straight away, it's like, wow, this is an early Cretaceous tyrannosauroid. We already knew at that time of a few early tyrannosauroids. Stokesosaurus from the Morrison Formation had been described by then, but the Chinese ones hadn't been. And so we realised, you know, due to these thickened, fused nasal bones and various other features, Eotyrannus was a Tyrannosaur. And of course, at that time, it wasn't called Eotyrannus. So the plan was, do this paper on it, describe it preliminarily. And this was all done in a tremendous rush. It had to be done before. This is the worst way to do science. Rush a paper out in order to get it out before a book, and the book has to be rushed out before the museum opens. So it wasn't the best state of affairs, and there was always a concern that our identification and ideas about Eotyrannus would prove wrong once we did more preparation work on it and such down the line. But it has actually held up. I did my PhD on Eotyrannus, finished it in 2006/7. So there is a monograph on Eotyrannus, like a 100-page description of it with like 100 illustrations and everything. And one of the great kind of, you know, things that I have hanging over me all the time is, why haven't I published that monograph? And I will tell you why, you'll know why. It's impossible to find the time in your life to finish a monograph, to go. It's been through review and everything. This work is done, but I just can't find the time to actually get it out there. And also, I made the mistake of agreeing to put it into a multi-authored volume, which is, less said about that, the better. But Eotyrannus is this significant early tyrannosauroid, an animal round about four metres long, with particularly elongate three-fingered hands. It's got some features that demonstrate that it was using kind of like a powerful bite. It was very good at conducting stresses through its skull, we think, but it's still got elongate hands that it's using for grabbing, that it uses to grab prey. So in that sense, it's very different from the famous tyrannosauroids of the late Cretaceous.
Are there any particularly strange dinosaur fossils from the Wealden? Any really weird thing, you know, you hear about these crazy dinosaur finds that nobody knows what the heck they're doing with things. Is there anything like that in the Wealden?
Yeah, there are a couple of particularly strange dinosaurs in the Wealden. But a similar problem to what I've said already, it's that they tend to be known from less than excellent material, which creates a problem. The one that was first outed as being particularly weird is a sauropod, known from a single vertebra that Mike Taylor and I described, and we named it Xenoposeidon prononeucos. And this single vertebra is so weird that, again, it's like there's no way this can belong to any of the known group of sauropods. So you're talking about a single vertebra that's got so many weird features. Wow, does it represent some entire... Are we prepared to say there's some entirely new group of sauropods only known from a single vertebra? I will say that recently we have been thinking that this vertebra does actually belong to a known group of sauropods, and we weren't able to appreciate that until this specific group of sauropods were described in more detail. So there is more to come on that story. So that's a notable one. And the other one is Beckelspinax, theropod, large theropod known from a few tall spined vertebrae that are coalesced and fused together. They're articulated, they are partially fused together. And it comes from a much older part of the Weald than the Wealden succession than virtually all other Wealden dinosaurs. So it's an old Wealden dinosaur and only known from these three vertebrae. We know that it's an allosauroid theropod of some kind, so a member of the same group as Allosaurus and the Carcharodontosaurs and such. And the recent discovery of Concavenator in Spain has led to suggestions that maybe Beckelspinax and Concavenator are maybe the same or related, but that has been investigated and it doesn't appear to be correct. They do appear to be, well, distinct, as in they should both keep their own names, and they aren't necessarily close to one another.
Weird. That's all I can think is weird. There are some other, not necessarily weird, but kind of interesting theropods from the Isle of Wight as well, like Baryonyx. Can you talk a little bit about the significance of Baryonyx and its weirdness?
Yeah. Today, Spinosaurids, and Spinosaurus in particular, are, you know, really familiar dinosaurs. And obviously there's this enormous amount of debate concerning the life appearance of Spinosaurus, this giant African theropod with a sail-like back. But well-known, you know, everyone that knows anything about dinosaurs will know this. Of course, Spinosaurus was discovered way back, the early 1900s, about 1915 in Egypt, and was only known from fragments. Obviously, it had a tall spine. Obviously, it had elongate, peculiarly shaped jaws compared to other theropods. But that's kind of all we knew about Spinosaurus until recently. The English discovery of baryonyx in 1983, it's published in 1986, that was hugely significant because some people recognised straight away that this was a close relative of Spinosaurus. It was a Spinosaurid. That it should turn up in southern England, of all places, was, you know, completely unexpected, a real surprise. And it demonstrated that Spinosaurids were theropods, because some people had occasionally contested that. They'd suggested that maybe they're weird giant crocodiliforms or some other group of archosaurs. And it demonstrated that they were robust, four-limbed, big, clawed, crocodile-headed bipedal theropods. So baryonyx, as this, the type specimen found at Ockley in Surrey, baryonyx walkeri, proved to be like a real big thing. When it was first published, it was said on the one hand to be completely new, a completely new kind of theropod, and no one had expected this group of theropods beforehand. You had some people saying that. On the other hand, you had some people saying, "Ah, no, that is a Spinosaurid." And either way, you know, both of them are equally exciting. The idea that it's a Spinosaurid turned out to be correct. There were a number of paleontologists contesting that, saying, "No, it's nothing to do with Spinosaurus, ignore that." And baryonyx has since proved to be a long-lived and widespread, kind of fairly ordinary animal in the Wealden succession. It's known from the whole succession, from the oldest rocks to the youngest rocks, not just in the English mainland, but it's found on the Isle of Wight. It's also known from continental Europe, Germany and Spain in particular. And this animal is around for a long time. It's around for like more than 20 million years. And what I think is interesting, I've mentioned this here and there, is that dinosaur species, as far as we can tell from the fossil record, aren't long-lived. Same as mammal species, you know, they stick around for a couple of million years. So we almost certainly don't have baryonyx walkeri around for that whole length of time. But do we have several species, multiple species of baryonyx? We don't know yet. The remains are often scrappy there, you know, old teeth and stuff. But there is variation in the teeth, which certainly makes it plausible that you might have more than one species. And Steve Sweetman and I are currently working on jaws and teeth of a baryonyx from the Isle of Wight. So the type material is from East Sussex, sorry, it's from Surrey. We've got this skeletal material of not just teeth, skeletal material as well, from the Isle of Wight. And we want to test whether it is baryonyx walkeri or whether it's a different species. Because there are a couple of differences people have noticed in the dentition. And there's also one vertebra, a baryonyx vertebra from the Isle of Wight, which is slightly different from the vertebrae of baryonyx walkeri.
How much of the skeleton of baryonyx is known?
Yeah, the type specimen is something like, at a guess, about half the skeleton.
Okay.
So once you add in what you know from other Spinosaurids, we've got a fairly good idea about what it's called. Suchomimus from Niger in particular, which is so similar to baryonyx that the suggestion has been made on a couple of occasions that they should be synonymized, maybe regarded as different species in the same genus. This is confused by the fact that there are African remains of baryonyx-like theropods that some experts have described as African records of baryonyx, and other experts have said that they are other things. There is these snout tips from Gadoufaoua in Niger were initially described as from baryonyx-like animals. Then they were said to be a new taxon called Cristatosaurus laparanti, and that was at about the same time as Suchomimus was published. Suchomimus is probably the same thing as Cristatosaurus, but now people have kind of forgotten that. They only talk about Suchomimus. And then you've got other people more recently, like Angela Milner, have said, oh, no, Suchomimus is just an African baryonyx. So whatever, they're all kind of similar close relatives within Spinosauridae, baryonychine Spinosaurids.
So you mentioned before that the Wealden covers, you know, many millions of years and Baryonyx has been found throughout it. But what about the other theropods? Are there different time periods where you're getting several large theropods all living together, or are they kind of separated through time?
Yeah, the vast majority of the Wealden dinosaurs we have come from one unit that crops out on the Isle of Wight called the Wessex Formation. And most Wealden dinosaurs, not all of them, but most of them come from the Wessex Formation, and most of them are contemporaneous. So roughly contemporaneous, they're living within tens of thousands to, you know, hundreds of thousands of years of each other. So we think that in the faunas that the Wessex Formation represents, yes, you really did have Baryonyx living alongside Neovenator, living alongside Eotyrannus, living alongside two or three smaller ones, smaller theropods, Thigosolaris, Calamosaurus, Calamospondylus. So, but that seems to be fairly typical for Mesozoic ecosystems.
Yeah.
These animals aren't necessarily sharing the same space, but they're within, you know, kilometres or tens of kilometres of one another. So you've got big predators controlling the main flow of resources, you know, killing the big herbivores, and then mid-sized ones that are staying out the big way, the big ones, and then smaller ones, which are staying out the way, the mid-sized ones and the bigger ones, and they're all doing different kind of things. But we do know of older, far older theropods. I mentioned Becklespinax is much older, Valdoraptor is much older, and they are definitely not contemporaneous with the Wessex Formation ones.
So of the contemporaneous Wessex Formation ones, is there evidence that they're significantly different in terms of maybe hunting styles, or maybe one was more scavenging and others were more predatory? Is there any kind of evidence of that, that would keep them separated?
I would say the only real kind of hard evidence for this is the fact that their skulls are really different. And, you know, they differ in anatomy in ways that you would interpret as meaning, this one is, you know, there's lots of evidence from the anatomy of Baryonyx that it's mostly an aquatic forager, you know, mostly preying on fish. It can eat little dinosaurs as well if it wants, but it's mostly predating on fish. Neovenator, presumably, as a big, narrow-skulled, deep-skulled mega predator, is going to be eating mostly terrestrial, large-ish dinosaurs. I don't think, by the way, that the dinosaurs like Neovenator were necessarily killing giant sauropods and big iguanodons. You know, they're probably mostly predating on human-sized and cow-sized animals. But then Eotyrannus, I don't know, is there an overlap between what it's doing and what Neovenator is doing? Maybe there is a little bit, but there are no good studies to demonstrate anything like niche partitioning at the moment. We would infer that it was the case, based on the fact they're, you know, sharing the same environment. But yeah, it looks likely that they're doing different things. There is actually some microwave work that's been done by Chris Barker here at the University of Southampton, and he and myself and Gareth Dyke and others, we've been looking at the microwear in Neovenator and trying to see if that tells us anything specific about the predation style of that animal. It fits into this whole controversy about how allosauroids predated Emily Rayfield's work and that of others, but I can't talk about that yet because it's a work in progress.
Moving kind of away from theropods and sort of towards the end and wrapping up, is there anything that's kind of missing that would be expected in the Wealden for the dinosaurs? You know, we have iguanodontids, we've got sauropods, we've got several different types of theropods. Is there any kind of major group that should be there that just isn't, or...?
Yeah, there's a huge number of questions that we have, or I have, about how similar or different some of these animals are compared to close relatives elsewhere. And there are a few groups that we predict might be present based on the assemblages of similar-aged faunas elsewhere. For example, Pelecanomimus-type ostrich dinosaurs. So at Las Hoyas in Spain, you've got a Barremian, so a certain age of Cretaceous deposit that's got seemingly the same species that we have in the Wessex Formation, including Baryonyx walkeri and Iguanodon benisartensis. And there's this bizarre, long-skulled, multi-toothed, supposed Ornithomimus or Pelecanomimus. I would like to know whether we have an animal like that in the Wealden, and at the moment we don't have anything like that. Although it's complicated by the fact that there's a recent argument that many of the small theropod remains from the Wealden are from ostrich dinosaurs, are from ornithomimosaurs. Uh-huh. But this is a, at the moment, this is kind of an unresolved mess. I don't know if the claim is relevant to Pelecanomimus. You shouldn't necessarily expect an animal to be found everywhere. I mean, the range has got to stop somewhere, right? But other than that, I mean, there's controversies about whether we've got this claim that we have pachycephalosaurs, thick-skulled dinosaurs. Mm. There's the whole issue of what Yavalandia is. I don't think it's a pachycephalosaur at all. There's this argument about whether we've got stegosaurs or not, which still hasn't been resolved. But otherwise, it's a kind of surprisingly diverse and elaborate dinosaur fauna. And it's, there's a lot going on there, really.
Yeah. And there's also ankylosaurs. Are there more than one ankylosaur, or is there just one that's found?
Yeah, there's a few. There's at least three, but they're not from the same places, not from the same strata.
Yeah.
Although this hasn't been... This also is not completely resolved. There's an animal that's typically associated with the Isle of Wight, Polacanthus foxy, which seems to be distinct from an animal known from the English mainland, Hylaeosaurus armatus. And everyone kind of agrees today, in the past they haven't, in the past they argued they're the same thing, but today everyone more or less agrees they are distinct taxa from different parts of the ankylosaur family tree even. But then there are things that are said to be Polacanthus that have been found at the same place as Hylaeosaurus. And there are bits and pieces of armour that come from the same place as Hylaeosaurus, which is said to be Polacanthus. And there's a species of Polacanthus, Polacanthus rudericensis, that comes from the English mainland, comes from a location and an age close to that that yields Hylaeosaurus. Then there's also this other Isle of Wight dinosaur, which... Stu Pond, here at Southampton, is currently doing his PhD, and Sarah Strachan is working on this animal as well. And this has always been assumed to be a Polacanthus, but it's almost certainly not. And that is kind of signifies a problem that we have with many of the Wealden dinosaurs, in that once people get in their minds the idea that there's a certain kind of concept of animal, like Iguanodon is the great example. Everyone knows that we have Iguanodon. So anything that looks vaguely like an Iguanodon is just labelled it and not really analysed. And, I mean, the Iguanodon story is complicated as well because in recent years, substantial debate as to how many species might be there.
Yeah, there's been lots that have been pulled out of Iguanodon and put into various things.
Yeah. A lot of the older Wealden ones have now been given their own names.
Yeah.
But then there's also... Greg Poole has got this cottage industry going of churning out new names for Wealden Iguanodontians. But I do think there is this... There's the same old lumping versus splitting argument, as there always is. But there's also this charge of social inertia, the idea that once you have in your mind... Once we as a community have in our mind the idea that all of the Baryonyx-like things are Baryonyx and all of the Polacanthus-like things are Polacanthus, people tend to label things... with those names, then often it, you know, look at when, once they're studied in detail, it might not prove to be the case. There might be even more taxa there.
So, kind of wrapping up, do you think that the Wealden still has a lot more interesting things to come? Are we still going to keep finding these groundbreaking discoveries in the Wealden, or do you think it's kind of settling?
Now, I think that it's actually kind of difficult to know what might happen in future, because I don't doubt that people are going to continue to find new bits and pieces that are going to be tumbling out of cliffs and found in the odd quarry pit and so on. People are always going to be finding maybe new species. That is happening, you know, like this new Baryonyx, Vecti Draco, published, was it last year, 2013.
Reference that paper enough to know.
Yikes. Yes, so new bits and pieces, but that's true of everywhere in the world, isn't it? I struggle to think of a way in which we might have some, you know, radical discovery, because the whole, like, landscape, the cultural, the, you know, the way things work, the human world is different than it was during this kind of golden Victorian age where they were finding so many new things. And it's hard to know, in a way, what we might hope for a place like the Wealden can't happen in the Wealden, and nobody is going to go and uncover like a kilometre of, you know, the new ground through quarrying or whatever. That kind of stuff is now happening elsewhere in the world. So you could sort of say that, you know, like China is the new Wealden, or bits of Argentina, or I can't see a nice simple answer to that one.
Do you think that there's any big studies that can still be done, even if it's not just finding a new discovery? You know, many people argue or are starting to argue that we should stop going out and looking for new fossils because another new species doesn't really change anything. It's not going to tell us anything amazing. So do you think there's kind of a next step to what could be done with what's already been found there?
Yeah, that is something I've thought about. And I've thought about that since going to private collections and seeing people that have picked up every single chunk of bone, and ending up with boxes and boxes of completely useless bone, hundreds or thousands of fragments of bone. These are in loads of museums around the southeast of England. And bear in mind, you know, southeast England, it's probably true to say it's probably got more museums than anywhere else in the world per area. Huge collections of fairly useless bits of bone that can't be studied. And as I said, many in private collections, local collections. Now, people have worked on techniques involving histology where you can identify useless chunks to a specific group. So an idea I have is that would it be possible to actually get some much more thorough, like, I don't want to say population level, because that implies you've got good representation of actual animals versus fossil ones, which of course we know you don't. But is there a better signal in the actual fossils that we've got as to how many groups, how they're distributed, what the diversity is really like across these faunas? And to do that study, you would need to collate and analyse an enormous amount of stuff that's, like I say, often privately owned.
Yeah.
So you'd have to work with people that have got stuff that's not in the public trust. And you'd also have to devise some quick and cheap, easy way of identifying bone fragments, chunks of bone. I'm talking about things that take up the size of your hand.
Yeah.
Things like that. Some quick and easy way to identify chunks of bone, to not necessarily to species, but to group level. And there are techniques that are out there, like Moldy Toff analysis, matrix assisted laser desorptionization, ionization time of flight. but to do that, you need like extensive laboratory time and kit that you can't really take into the field.
So you think questions of sort of diversity and maybe disparity, that kind of thing, is the next place to look at for the Wealden?
Yeah, maybe. It would be really interesting to have a better handle on how many animals were living at one time, and how rare theropods were or how common theropods were, things like that.
Yeah. Well, great. I think that's great. Thanks for joining us, Darren.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @PaleoCast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.